the two we read talked about last time. High beauty is a celebration of the multiplicity and individual beauties of creation within a harmony. It's a kind of paradoxical idea. Incorporating one of Hopkins' most basic ideas is that nature is word, expression, news of God. And of course, nature poetry then is also that. Another of his ideas related to that is that all things praise God by being what they are. That cherishing of individuality, not individualism, but individuality. It's a very important part of Hopkins' poetry, and so you can see why that would be important for people at Holden Village. He became a Jesuit priest in 1868. He was born into a fairly comfortable middle-class English family who were Anglicans, and you can imagine they were absolutely horrified when their oldest son turned Jesuit, an expression which he himself used. But there isn't a whole lot in his poem sometimes. It seems very Catholic to many people, which is one of the reasons, or perhaps it's Catholic in the broader sense of the word, one of the reasons why Gerard Hopkins is accessible to Holden people sometimes. The other poem we read, As Kingfishers Catch Fire, is also a celebration of individuality. And more than that, because Hopkins is a poet priest, not just a poet who celebrates nature, a poet who celebrates God in nature. And he says in Kingfishers, in the second stanza, Christ, in the last part of the poem, Christ plays in 10,000 places. Plays could mean all kinds of things, you know, almost like a movie played in many movie houses, but certainly the sense of movement, activity, and delight involved in that word are part of what he means. Christ plays in 10,000 places, lovely in limbs, and lovely in eyes not his to the Father through the features of men's faces. As you can see just from that little bit, he has odd ways of expressing himself. He prized individuality partly because I'm sure he was a bit of an eccentric fellow himself. And he was very much ahead of his time, so much so that although he died in 1889 at age 45, tragically young, he still did not see the publication of his poems. He felt it would be unseemly for him to publish poems as a Jesuit priest, though he did write them. But he also was retarded somewhat by the reactions of the people with whom he corresponded, who were really his only audience, a couple of his Oxford friends and a few others. And most of all, Robert Bridges, who became a very important English poet. Robert Bridges was met him in Oxford, and they connected later on, and they wrote a lot of letters back and forth about Hopkins' poetry, which, many of which are published in this book. Now, this is not the cover that's currently on the book. They've changed it to a black and white cover. Does anybody have that book that's the bookstore is selling right now?
What's that?
Well, Gerard Manley Hopkins' Poems and Prose, Penguin Paperback. Good selection of the stuff. And his sermons and letters. He left a lot of prose writings behind. We're going to look at some tonight. Are eloquent and wonderful, just to get to know him as a person. But they're out of print. Oxford University Press has about four volumes or so. You can't buy them anymore. So these little collections are very valuable. This is one that's been around a long time. Yeah.
And that includes sermons?
I think there's one or two in there. There's another collection of the prose I can recommend that has a few more. And then your library would have the Oxford Press whole book of them. They're wonderful to read.
Do you have any more of those sheets?
Well, yes.
Thank you very much.
We're being niggardly with it tonight, which is not in the spirit of Holden or Hopkins.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Anyway, Robert Bridges was offended and confused a lot of the time by the obscurity of Hopkins' poetry. But he felt that there was not an audience for it in 1885 or so, and that he would have to wait until an audience developed. Well, finally the poetry was published by 1918. Long time after Hopkins died. And he became very influential then on a new generation of post-World War I poets, like T.S. Eliot and other people. these letters that I mentioned between Robert Bridges and Gerard Hopkins are very touching and sometimes very sad, because Hopkins keeps insisting, you know, that you've got to read my poetry aloud, then you'll hear it, then it'll make sense to you. And, you know, Robert Bridges will complain about this image or that rhyme, and he used to do that in Victorian poetry. And finally, on one occasion, Gerard says, "You say that you would not for any money read my poem again. Nevertheless, I beg you will. Besides money, you know, there is love." So I beg you to read his poems more than once for the sake of love, if they make total nonsense to you at first. I think poetry is nonsense, and that's one of the values of it. It breaks open our minds and helps us to see things in new ways. Our common sense is sometimes not reality. And poems do that. And Gerard Hopkins reminds us of that, because when we read his poems, we don't know what he's saying at first sometimes. But the obscurity that is we find in his poems is part of the effect he was looking for. And let me quote a letter from 1879, where he says to Robert Bridges, "No doubt my poetry errs on the side of oddness. I hope in time to have a more balanced and Miltonic style. But as melody is what strikes me most of all in music, and design in painting, so design, pattern, or what I am in the habit of calling inscape, is what I above all aim at in poetry." Inscape. S-C-A-P-E. Typical of Hopkins to invent words. This one, based, you know, of course, on analogy with landscapes, and we've invented all kinds of other words, haven't we? Seascape and cityscape and so on. Well, what is inscape? Hopkins was always in the habit of looking very hard at things for their central law or principle of being, either an object or a group of objects, to look for what it is that makes that thing or person or poem or emotion unique. Okay. So that's part of this. It's cherishing of uniqueness in his theology. And so when you read about him, you find it, you know, in his letters, he tells about staring at an oak tree a long time to figure out how it's organized. You don't figure that out in 2 minutes, right? Or he would describe a cloud he saw floating across the sky as something that's cut out from a lost hole. How many of us would think of that? He's always thinking in terms of the uniqueness of a thing and the pattern into which it fits. Or he'd stand on a cliff, and in England there are magnificent cliffs, as some of you may know, look down and draw, he was a good draughtsman, and draw how the waves were coming in, the lines of the surf. That's not easy. And he has some very fine drawings, which are in these Oxford books, that they reproduced, pictures that show what a good eye he had for things. And this is very Victorian in a way. I mean, the Victorian era is the age of fact, of scientific observation, or advances in science. And in a way, it's a typical Victorian thing to do, to be obsessed by the way things look, factually speaking. But of course, that's not where he stops. He even would draw things like the way the scum in standing milk in his room in Oxford would look. Nothing was too lowly to attract his eye, because God made it all. So let me give you some quick definitions of inscape. You know, university people are supposed to be giving definitions, so you all take this down. One of the definitions, he uses the word in a whole lot of different ways, and it's in the 1860s and 70s in his journals, and he begins to use the word inscape and sort of play with it. One is, the inscape is the special individualizing pattern that distinguishes one person, object, emotion, or poem from another. Not the attribute of it, but it's a pattern, it's a distinguishing pattern. Okay, another quick definition is that inscape is the especial unity of being of something. What I would call its inner form, what gives it integrity, what makes it hold together as distinct from all other things. A third possible definition, he said, inscape is the very soul of art. Art has to hang together, unifying. partly why you read poems and involve yourself in other artistic experiences, is to experience wholeness for the space of 5 minutes, an hour, whether it's a ballet, a symphony, a poem, or whatever. It's time out from the chaos of our lives to experience that. There are other reasons you go to those things. The opposite, too, for breaking apart your ordinary conceptions and for being challenged. So, fourth definition, inscape is a key to divine harmony in the world. The world has inscape, and it's proof of God's pattern, God's design. Now, if I could read you a little passage from this this book, my chewing gum for later, makes great bookmarks. It's very dim in here, isn't it? Okay, here's an example of he uses the word inscape in this eventually.
There we go. 1973.
This is a description of snow. I thought you might like it since it was so hot today. In the snow, and you have to try to visualize this without, you know, giving up if you can't visualize it all, but you'll pick it up. In the snow, flat-topped hillocks and shoulders outlined with wavy edges, ridge below ridge, very like the grain of wood, in line and in projection like relief maps. Now, notice that right away he's making similes, making comparisons. Relief maps, grain of wood, pattern of snow. That's very typical of Hopkins. So look for likenesses in nature. He's not saying the grain of wood is the snow and the snow is the wood. No, because if that were true, then everything would be alike. But everything is similar or connected, but different. And he's always looking for those kinds of further examples of a similar pattern. These the wind makes, these ridges, I think, and of course drifts, which are in fact snow waves. He takes one area of life, you know, water, and transfers it to another, which makes sense, of course. Not, you know, scientific anymore. The sharp nape of a drift, there he's using the word nape in an odd way, the sharp nape of a drift is sometimes broken by slant flutes or channels. I think this must be when the wind, after shaping the drift first, has changed and cast waves in the body of the wave itself. All the world, he goes on, is full of inscape, and chance, left free to act, falls into an order as well as purpose. Looking out of my window, he says, I caught it, inscape, in the random clods and broken heaps of snow made by the cast of a broom. The same of the path, trenched by footsteps in ankle-deep snow across the fields leading to hotter wood, through which we went to see the river. The sun was bright, the broken brambles and old boughs and banks lined and cloyed with white. The brook down the clough pulling its way by drops and by bubbles in turn under a shell of ice. Can you kind of see it first? Very descriptive. All the world is full of inscape. A couple more things I'd like to say about that before beginning to talk to you about another companion term that he develops. As I said before, nothing was too lowly to escape his eye, because to Hopkins, God made it all. Nothing was too trivial. I was thinking of this inscape of his from a journal when the flowers die on my dining room table. You know, I buy the flowers, bring them home on Sunday afternoon, put them there, and then the week goes by, and I'm so busy, I hardly have time to look at them. And then by the end of the week, you know, all over the place, people are kidding me about having dead flowers my dining room table. And he says, the horned violet is a pretty thing, gracefully lashed. Even in withering, the flower ran through beautiful inscapes. I like that. And there are flowers that do, and there are flowers that don't. He might find it beautiful. He was an obscure priest. He was not well known, and he was not particularly good. I like reading his sermons, but you know, they weren't very successful. In fact, his order censored a lot of them. He gave a sermon once on love that his superiors thought was a little bit too, I don't know, explicit or realistic. And one time he was giving a sermon, I think it was to someplace like Manchester or Liverpool, in a packed church by working people. And he thought people were crying. He thought they were so moved by his sermon. And after a while he realized it was sweat they were wiping off their faces. Now he had a lot of disappointments as a preacher. He was obscure as a poet, even more so because he was unknown and unpublished in an era where people did cherish fame. You know, he has discussions of fame in his journal. People don't talk about fame anymore. Back then they still did. He was not famous. And it was things like him that he noticed. He said, I thought how surely beauty of Inscape was unknown and buried away from the simple people. And yet how near at hand it was if they had eyes to see it. If they had eyes to see it. Now where are we going to get their eyes? Where do you get eyes from? Yeah. But what if you can't see out of your eyes? How do you know? Through reading poems, that's one thing. Or writing them. Or observing things around you, or learning from people like this. Obviously, when he says a thing like that, he wants to be one of the people who bring those Inscapes out for people to see. In all of English poetry, he's probably the most faithful observer of clouds and skies, and I always think of him when it's a drive across Montana from Chicago out to Holyoke. It's a very long drive across Montana, and there ain't nothing to look at sometimes but the sky. And some of the clouds are really wonderful.
That's why it's cold in the East Drive.
What?
That's why it's cold in the East Drive.
I know, I figured that out. Here's a description of sky. Below the sun, it was like clear oil, but just as full of color. Shaken over with slanted, flashing travelers, all in flight, stepping one behind the other, their edges tossed with bright raveling, as if white napkins were thrown up in the sun, but not quite at the same moment, so that they were all in a scale down the air, falling one after the other to the ground. Isn't that amazing? He became sometimes so involved in the Inscape of a scene that it seemed like the whole world to him. And in describing a tree one time, he says, I saw the Inscape freshly as if my eye were still growing. And we talk about growth, spiritual growth, emotional growth, intellectual growth. We don't talk about eye growth, vision growth. And his grows, not, you know, in general, but as he's looking, his eye grows, as he's exercising his sight. And obviously it's insight and not just external sight. There's a poignant note in his diary that tells of a tree's death. Not by natural causes, as happens out here in the Northwest, with a forest littered with dead trees, perfectly natural, part of the process, but by human nature. He says, the ash tree growing in the corner of the garden was felled. It was locked first. I heard the sound, and looking out and seeing it maimed, there came at that moment a great pang, and I wished to die and not to see the Inscapes of the world destroyed anymore. It's almost as though the tree is alive. And of course it is. He has a poem about the death of poplars that records that experience. And this is a little bit of that poem. All fell, fell, all are felled, of a fresh and following folded rank, not spared, not one. 10 or 12, only 10 or 12 strokes of havoc, unselved them. Unselved is the opposite of selving, of praising God by being what you are. I'd like to share with you, before we look at two other poems tonight, some examples of his journal writing, which I copied out for you. Although I don't want to discourage you from buying the book from the bookstore. It's an inexpensive paperback. Because riches that you can dip into for many years to come. But I just picked some out. So I want you to see what they look like, and in a minute I'm going to give you the slides. Nothing to do, Mr. Bright, now, but later. These are prose inscapes of his, and I thought maybe we could get into his poetry a little better by looking at those first. And what I thought we might do here is just read a few, and not all of them, and talk about how he writes them, what he's trying to do, and how he's doing it. For example, number two. July 1st, it says. Starts off, sharp showers, bright between. To me, that's significant because what he's doing there is right away he's got the structure of the day. Right? Sharp showers, bright between. That's the structure of the experience. It's like a thesis statement, as we say in freshman composition. And then he goes on to elaborate what the experience was like. Late in the afternoon, the light and shade being brilliant, snowy blocks of cloud were filing over the sky, and under the sun, hanging above and along the earth line, were those multitudinous up and down, crispy sparkling chains with pearly shadows up to the edges. At sunset, which was in a gray bank, with moist gold dabs and racks, the whole round of skyline had level clouds, naturally lead color, but the upper parts ruddled, some more, some less, rosy. Spits or beams, braided or built in with slanting pellet flakes, made their way. Through such clouds, anvil-shaped pink ones and upblown fleece of wool, flat-topped, dangerous-looking pieces. What's he doing there with language? How does he write these things? I mean, obviously, it's very unique in his form of expression.
He writes the way they feel.
Yeah? Where do you pick that up? In what words?
What's the rhythm of the landscape?
Yeah. There's rhythm in that? Not at home. Can prose have rhythm? Sure can. That's very good. And often he goes for rhythm. Even sharp showers bright between. That's got a rhythm. Anybody else notice things he does with language here to describe this inscape, this scene?
There's almost an urgency to it, like he really needs to, just with a few strokes, paint the picture so that you kind of flung into it.
There's no wasted words, you know? No chatty going on. He just gets right into it. Yes.
I wonder about that. I mean, he has a reason, but I think in that third to the last line, the oars get teaches. Why doesn't he just say spits or beams instead of spits or beams? And then why doesn't he say braided instead of braided or built?
That's a real good question. You know, we're taught to be simple, clear, and direct in our writing. I call that the slam bam thank you ma'am method of writing that we're taught in the United States. People in other cultures don't communicate that way. And when I teach students from India and from Cuba and, you know, other places in Central America, and black students and all kinds of, you name it, each of those cultures has its own kind of rhetoric, but it's not slam bam thank you ma'am English. That's just one thing to say about that. You may find it tedious. I think there's some reasons why he piles up words like that.
That's what I want to know.
Yeah. Anybody got a theory?
He's building momentum, or...
Yeah. Okay. He's building, doing something there on purpose. Any other ideas about this? It's an interesting feature of his style. Building up the clouds himself?
I don't know.
In piling up the words. Yeah. Anybody else have a theory about that?
Making us think as to what it might be.
But he wrote this for himself.
Of course.
But to make anybody, you know, make himself think or to reflect his thinking.
I think usually when you write a journal, you
tend to write quickly and perhaps not think through and might just want to jot a couple of different ways of saying something.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm.
Maybe this is the way he sees things, too. He sees things in that kind of pattern.
Well, you see it one way and then you see it another at the same time and then you write them both down.
He often holds a couple of ideas in his mind at the same time. Somebody once said that Hawkins seems like a poet who's trying to utter all his thoughts at once.
Some of the rest of us have trouble coming up with one word, and he can start with
it's real intimidating.
Yes.
Did he ever paint?
Yes.
He did.
And he thought about becoming a poet painter like Dante Gabriel Rossetti or William Blake, who are heroes.
Makes me feel like he's painting.
Uh-huh. Yeah. It is word painting. Only with words you can paint it a couple of ways.
Right. And that's what he's doing, right?
But it's not a picture that really quite registers, does it? I mean, if you have all those alternatives, you can't quite envision it.
Well, it's stuff that he could cross one of them out if he was going to try to publish it.
Yeah. It's not revised.
You know, but it feels like...
Spits or beans? Now, spit, I mean, I guess he means a land spit. Is that what you thought? You know, spit of land? Mm-hmm. Or, and of course, clouds could look like that, or beams, which makes them seem stronger somehow. Maybe these clouds are changing, like before his eyes, and he's capturing that. Or maybe his perception is changing. You can't tell. Braided or built? Different words.
Well, now, is built connected with in with slanting pellet flakes?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's what I didn't notice. I mean, is braided as related to in with slanting pellet flakes as built is?
That's what we don't know.
Yeah.
And I don't think Hawkins is too worried about us choosing. Or he is maybe not worried about choosing either. There's a kind of excess here that not everybody would like, you know. Some people think Hopkins is just too excessive and they like simple poetry, just a few words. It's a partly matter of taste. But Hopkins loves words and he loves to use words. And there are people like that, and if they can think of four words, they'd rather use four. And the test for somebody like that is, you know, do those four each say something different? Because if they don't, then it's just redundancy. This is a multiplicitous world he celebrates. He doesn't see with just one eye. And his eye is growing as he sees, so he's going to use these different expressions. Let's look at one more. There's a wonderful, by the way, right under that. You see the July 11th when he was in Switzerland, he says, how fond of and warped to the mountains it would be easy to become. And he goes on to describe more snow. His descriptions of snow and flowers here are really wonderful.
Is he in the German part of Switzerland at that point?
I don't know. I don't remember. Why?
Well, I was thinking it sounded like a Germanic construction.
Oh. I don't think Germanic is one of the languages that he really was influenced by. Who knows? Maybe it is. Let's look down at August 10th. That's a real short one, 1872. He says, it is pretty to see the dance and swagging of the light green tongues or ripples of waves in a place locked between rocks. Have you ever tried to describe water? Railroad Creek, Holden Lake, water caught between rocks. He just uses a couple of words here, dance and swagging. What does swagging mean? I'm not sure I know, but I think I know. Goes like this? Goes which way? Back and forth? Like this?
A Christmas swag, it goes like that.
Yeah. So there's kind of curving motion in the water and dance, which dance might suggest, you know, up and down, maybe, I don't know. Dance and swagging of the light green tongues or ripples. A lot of times he uses words that refer to voice or tongues in his poetry, and here he's got the water as tongues. And notice too how he falls into Ron, easy, locked between rocks. He loves to do that kind of thing. He can't help himself. There are more examples here, and I'd invite you to read these when you go off to wherever you go. And if you'd like to take part in this, anybody who'd like to, I want to invite you to write an inscape of your own. Now, this could be an inscape of a thing or a group of things. I wouldn't take anything too ambitious, but that's up to you. Or it could be a person, it could be a face, it could be a telling gesture that a person makes. It could be any number of human or natural things in the world of physical nature. And anyway, you could make it one word. That's all you could come up with. That's enough. Or a simile, or a sentence, or a paragraph, whatever. You want to try it? If you said you can come up with one word, then do one word. And do it in your own way. You have to follow his formulas. But let me point out how simple he gets these started. Some people have trouble getting started. The formula he keeps using here is, first of all, July 1, he summarizes the day and then he goes on. Another formula in July 11 is, we saw, dot, 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 dot. I watched, dot, dot, dot. Such and such were a beautiful sight, and then he goes on to describe them. You don't want to use too many words like beautiful, marvelous, you know, the kind of words you use on postcards. Keep it concrete. It is pretty to see, dot, dot, dot. You could start out that way. That might get you going a little bit. See if you can write just a bit of an inscape of your own that helped your eye to grow around Holden Village. Let me suggest a method that Herb Brokering used to tell us. Does anybody remember Herb Brokering when he used to come up here? He used to do his eye openers in the morning.
Yeah.
I just want to take him home with me. You know, I needed him in the morning. Open my eyes. But one of the things I remember him doing is to stick a pencil through a piece of paper. And he'd say, okay, now, you know, you're not seeing anything, so look through that tiny, tiny hole. And you'll see more than you ever saw before. And it's true. It's sort of the way, you know, you look through your camera, tiny eye, and you see a lot. So you might try that. Make a little piece of paper and look at something with that, because it focuses for you.
I don't know how many of us have writing through.
What do you mean?
Do you want us just to think of?
No, write it down with a pencil.
I don't know how many of us have pencils.
I don't mean right now.
You can't. Oh, I thought, okay.
We'll do it. No, go out and do it in the world out there. And bring them tomorrow, if you like, at this 7 o'clock session. We'll share some. I'll try to do it, too. It's real hard. But not impossible, because, you know, we see things. I always ask my writing students to do haiku poems, because they're short and simple to write. And, you know, these people are mechanics, they're hairdressers, they're waitresses, they're librarians, they're all kinds of people, and they always come up with something. Everybody comes up with something. Of course, they're, you know, under penalty of law, doom and punishment, whereas you are, you know, under the rainbow here. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just wondering about when you're describing something and it has some darker or more negative aspect.
Uh-huh.
If that is really in keeping with his idea of inscape.
Dangerous looking clouds are in there.
Yeah.
In fact, if you look at the last one, it's an inscape. It's actually a kind of contradiction in terms. It's an inscape of things falling apart. The end of it is, this is a bad experience he had. Things not ready, darkness and despair. In fact, being unwell, I was quite downcast. Nature in all her parcels and faculties gaped and fell apart. Fatasibat, like a cloud cleaving and holding only by strings of root. That's how he felt. But even in making that simile, he is creating an inscape.
So if you get to the heart of it, even if it has some darkness, it's still...
That's part of what's there. Anybody else have something you want to say about this? I really encourage you to try it. Yes.
Oh, not about that. I missed the introduction. But are there sketches and paintings that he's done?
Mm-hmm. I've only seen them in the Oxford Journals and Papers by G. Gordon Mary Hopkins. You can find it in any college library, certainly. Yeah, it's an intersection of just being a movement. I don't know where you can see the actual drawing in English.
So much of what you've read, it seems like it's just creating such a picture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's very visual, but he gave up painting because he felt, as he put it, it would put a strain upon the passions, which I should not like to encounter, he said. Very Victorian kind of thing. But poetry was a little more seemly.
He didn't want to encounter the restraint or the
passions. The passions.
Oh.
So he writes this incredibly sensuous poem. This word. He developed a companion term. Inscape, you know, again, one is never enough. The world is various, and there's another word. In stress. Now, what is stress in daily life?
What is it?
Too much.
Too much. Okay. What is stress?
Aggravation.
Pressure.
Tension.
Where does it come from? Outside or inside?
Inside.
We need
inside. What is it in architecture? Any architects in the room?
It's a material.
How is stress important in architecture?
It balances. You've got to build your structure to withstand the stress.
That's right.
There's going to be stress.
Yeah.
So you got to balance it out. And in an arch. You couldn't have an arch without stress and counter stress, right? To hold it up. You can't get rid of stress in nature or life. But there are things to do with it that are creative.
Stress goes with strain.
Stress goes with strain.
There's a relationship between stress and strain.
Okay.
There is.
Okay.
I suppose without stress we would be blah.
That's true. Now, stress is both a noun and a verb, and that's one of the important things here, because Hopkins uses this both as a noun and a verb. He's always changing around the parts of speech. This is another part of his nonsense. You can't, you know, just, what do we use to do? Diagram his sentences? As a verb, to stress means to create tension. Now, there's another way to use the word stress. That means to emphasize something, right? Or to hold something as very important in your life. Now, stress in poetry means some additional things. Anybody know a bit about poetry that can say what stress is? What?
It's kind of a lot of travel in big cities and stuff. Okay. With all that.
And that was an important thing for Hopkins because he was an urban priest a lot of the time in his career. What were you guys saying? Okay. We did this the other day. I'm not going to teach you how to do this. This is not a class. But a stress in poetry is a strong beat. There's strong beats and weaker beats. So you have Girard, weak stress, strong stress. And there are many ways that a poet can stress things. And Hopkins' poems are full of stresses, but they are balanced and worked with and shaped so that the poem holds together like the arch standing up. And there are a lot of ways a poet can stress things. He can stress them by putting strong accents on them. He can stress them even more by putting two strong accents together. Da-da, like that. He can repeat words or sounds or colors or images. You also stress something by where you place it. You can put it at the end of a sentence, and that gives it more stress, more emphasis, than if you put it somewhere in the middle, maybe, or at the beginning. So there are two definitions of in stress I'm going to give you. In stress, and there are more, but just two right now. He would call in stress the force of being that holds the inscape together. Inscape is a little too static for him, so he develops this concept of in stress. It holds inscape together, and the theological definition then is that in stress is God's will in and through all things, stressing, making much of creation, of you, of me, and everything around us, saving it, that's stress. And this quote here goes on. says, all things are charged with love, are charged with God. And if we know how to touch them, they give off sparks and take fire, deal drops and flow, ring and tell of him. The poet has to stress God's in stress in order to make it clear to people who can't see it, can't feel it. Let me read you a poem. It's full of in-stress. This is at the on the left side, God's grandeur. The world is charged with the grandeur of God. It will flame out like shining from shook foil. It gathers to a greatness like the ooze of oil crushed. Why do men then now not wreck his rod? Generations have tried, have tried, have tried, and all is seared with trade, leered, smeared with toil, and wears man's smudge and shares man's smell. The soil is bare now, nor can foot feel the shod. And for all this, nature is never spent. There lives the dearest freshness deep down things. And though the last lights off the black west went, oh morning at the brown brink eastward springs, cause the Holy Ghost over the bent world broods with warm breath. And with bright wings. What is God's grandeur in this poem? Yeah?
Soil.
What?
Soil.
Okay. And what was Pied Beauty is about the attributes of creation. If you have a chance to read it later, we read it the other day. God's grandeur is about action. It's about action of God and human beings. Actions of from death and recreation. And it moves in very important ways. It's a very active poem in the sense that it goes somewhere, it starts somewhere, and goes somewhere else. And there are a couple of different aspects of God's grandeur in this poem. Again, not just one. It starts out with one kind of God, or one attribute, or aspect of God, or action of God, and ends with another. Two ways that God stresses and saves creation. Do you see that? Just look at the first line and the last line. That gives you an idea right there of where the poem is going. What kind of God is introduced at the beginning?
God of creation.
What?
God of creation.
Uh-huh.
Power.
Power? Zeus. Will flame out, you know, that old lightning bolt God, isn't it? It's an apocalyptic warning kind of God. And it's a very powerful sort of judgment day God that's suggested by these images. The world is charged with the grandeur of God. It will flame out. Instead of saying like lightning, which would be a little dull and obvious, he goes into a simile, like shining from shook foil. Well, who would have thought of that?
The brooding God. God broods, hovers, broods.
And how is that different from the God of judgment day in the beginning? If it moves in that direction, what kind of God is that, or aspect of God?
Introspective.
Yeah?
Continually involved, continually there.
Uh-huh.
Protective.
Not the once, uh-huh. The one-time judgment, but the caring, brooding.
Repentant. What?
Repentant.
Uh-huh.
Are you looking for the word
repentant?
Yes,
she is. Why didn't you say that? That never occurred to me. I think that's one way people do interpret this. It does move from a kind of masculine image of God, what we thought of as masculine, to something we thought of as feminine. And of course, these images are very biblical. And the brooding dove, brooding over the world. That last line, too, by the way, is an echo of Milton. Milton talks about God in the creation in Paradise Lost. He says that God, with mighty wings outspread, dove-like, sat brooding over the vast abyss. I'm glad Hopkins didn't develop a Miltonic style. Milton would never have said warm breast like that. Ah, bright wings. Milton would never have done that. There's a kind of intimacy and closeness and love and sensuousness here, and I think femininity that Milton doesn't really include in his image. So there's that kind of movement too, but in Lutheran terms, I guess, we're kind of moving here from a God of law to a God of grace, who is continually recreating the world. Now, what happens in the middle?
The fall.
Okay. You could call this a kind of creation and fall poem. It sort of moves through that, doesn't it? That biblical process of creation and fall and recreation, it's all encapsulated here in these few lines. Generations, what's he talking about? Have trod, have trod, have trod, and all is seared with trade, bleared, smeared with toil, and wears man's smudge, shares man's smell. Soil is bare now, nor can foot feel being shod. What's he talking about?
Sounds like the Garden of Eden. With the fall and the marking the cane, and I mean, you could really get carried away thinking about that in that context. It may not mean that at all.
There are a lot of associations packed in here, and the mark of Cain is something I hadn't thought of, but that's certainly part of it, that smudge that we wear on Ash Wednesday.
It seems like work and war and destruction and roads being built and cities and
denial of God. Yeah, that was in God's grace. That's all right. You can not destroy you. I will, you know, the thing you see in the Bible, I guess people were talking earlier about with Moses or something, and then not much about it, but how he was saying, I'm getting so angry, I'm just going to destroy this. And he says, well, wait a minute, take a look. You know, there are some good people there. That was
incredible. Doesn't end, fortunately, with that first eight lines, does it? The whole poem kind of starts out in this grand way, and then it gets to sag, slows down in the middle, and then starts up again. That repetition of trod, have trod, have trod is a way of Hopkins stressing a problem by exact repetition, not by slight variation or synonyms, by exact repetition. What does that line remind you of?
Generation.
Uh-huh.
People repeating, failing to learn the lessons of history, repeating its mistakes.
And that road of history kind of suggested in that trot, except that it's more like a treadmill, isn't it?
I wonder if it's hard for us to believe, you know, he almost says, no matter what we do to the earth, somehow nature is never spent. We live 100 years later. We see the possibility of maybe nature being spent.
It gives me the feeling that man just goes on and on, and he doesn't really appreciate what's there. It seems almost like a lament that man or other people can't see that. And then he goes on with the beauty of it.
That's right. Nor can foot feel being shod. I mean, the very work routine that are suggested here prevent us from seeing what's around us, just like I let my flowers die sometimes during the week because I'm rushing by them. This is one way that's expressed. Karen Bloomquist the other day had a diagram on the board, what she called the good life cycle. Does anybody see that? That's trod, 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 and going around in that treadmill circle of work, never getting anywhere really. Never being able to break out of it. And the only way this poem says you can break out of that is through yielding to the grace of God that comes in this last stanza. For all this nature is never spent. Now, it's not just talking about nature, but about God in nature. And so The rest of the poem explains why is nature never spent. And a lot of times Hopkins does this, explains why something is so. Well, because there lives the dearest freshness deep down things. What does that mean? And though the last lights go off here, morning is coming up here. And if you've ever seen that happen, that's very exciting to kind of feel the dawn coming up. And then he goes on with another because. Why does that happen? Because the Holy Ghost is giving birth to the world once again. Hopkins was very fond of Holy Ghost imagery, and it's interesting because the Holy Spirit is coming back into popularity now in different ways. Leonardo Boff, the liberation theologian from Latin America, uses images of the Holy Spirit to talk about the authority that people should pay attention to. It's very threatening to the institutional church, as well it might be. It's also his interest in the Holy Spirit that prompted one of my students at Northwestern, and what I think was my first class that I remember, to write a paper on Hopkins' poetry and Black Baptist preaching. She found a connection between them. Her father was a Black Baptist preacher. And one of them was his constant reference to the Holy Spirit, who is a kind of muse for him, M-U-S-E.
Is there a connection?
No. Bring it, my students? No.
Can I back up a little? We've been wrestling with a question over here.
Okay.
In that line, why do men then now not R-E-C-K, it's Rod, right? Uh-huh. Rod.
Okay.
What awkward.
It's an awkward line, isn't it?
Yeah.
What especially puzzles you?
Well, what is meaning?
Oh.
What is the rod?
Okay, the rod. What is the rod, folks?
R-E-C-K.
You parents out there, what's the rod?
Well.
Okay. The punishment.
Why do men not wreck his rod, his law?
Wreck means?
W-R-E-C-K?
No, well, not really.
To go against.
Well, they've made a wreck, but... Pay attention to. That's what it means. Pay attention to.
Oh, reckon.
Yeah, reckon.
Okay. Oh.
See how he cuts out everything that would water down the poem, but then it takes you 4 years to figure out. But it's there. Why do men then now not wreck his rod? Is an awkward line, deliberately so.
What about this? The soil is bare now. Is that referred to deforestation and stuff like that?
England is a very beautiful country. I'm sure some of you have been there and know how really idyllic it is. But the Industrial Revolution ruined large tracts of it. And other English Romantic poets and then later Victorians like Gerard Hopkins were very concerned about that. And so partly it's a social statement. The pollution, you know, pouring evil-smelling purple dye into those gorgeous little brooks and rivulets in England and just, you know, killing the grass like the tailings killing things with the cyanide. It's pollution. It's the industrial wastelands that were created. It's partly a social statement. Hopkins is not an apolitical nature poet, I don't think. Sometimes you have to work to apply what he's saying. Anybody have any questions about meaning in this poem? See, I've read it so many times. To me, it's clear enough, I guess. I mean, I was finding things in it. Maybe it's not so clear. Well, it's 5 till 8. Shall we go to Vespers?